of Homer. When we were in the court case out in Seattle about the teaching of the higher criticism in the schools out there, we found that the man who teaches the course in the Bible of Literature in the University of Washington believes that the medieval writing called Piers Plowman in England was written by four different sources. But it was interesting that in the course of the discussion in the court there, he mentioned that when a book was recently published in London on Piers Plowman, and he having written video on it, they asked him for a contribution. He said that when he sent him one, giving his theory of sources, they wrote back and said they were very much surprised. They didn't know there was anybody left today who still believed that you could divide Piers Plowman into sources. It's now quite generally agreed in the name of the author and that this one man wrote it. He said he personally was not at all sure that this particular man had ever even actually lived. This, of course, is England back in the 14th century. And it shows how survivals of that source division view still remain in the field of literature, but there are very, very few of them. And most have just quietly abandoned the search for sources, except in the study of the Bible, where you have a different group altogether. And those in literary studies mostly know very little about the Bible and simply refer to a book by one of the latest scholars in the biblical field in some university and take what he says about it. But it is a very great change in literary proof. And so when you pick up a book and it says that in approaching the Bible, we must consider it as literature and approach it as we would any other literature, I think it is well to remember, why not approach it as other literature is approached today, instead of as other literature was approached a century ago. Now we go on to Roman numeral 11. And 11 will be the argument for development, alleged discrepancy. Arguments for development, alleged discrepancy. You remember that we noticed that the study of sources of the Bible, of the Pentateuch in particular, had gone on for many decades and had been followed by a considerable number of scholars, though there were a larger number of scholars who rejected it, and the world at large knew nothing about it. But that this other movement had been carried on by a still smaller number of scholars, the movement to study development of the ideas and institutions of Israel as a purely a human development. And then that with the great increase in acceptance of Hegelian and evolutionary concepts, that Groff, Kuhnen, and Wellhausen united these two streams, and that was what gave the Groff-Wellhausen hypothesis its great step forward, and what won it very quickly almost complete dominance in the scholarly world and a very wide acceptance among church people in general, which has been widening ever since. So that in all our large denominations today, you will occasionally have Sunday school lessons which will have a chart showing the timeline of the Bible and indicating when the J document was written, when the E and when the D and so on. And it is taken as something that is established fact. Now, as we notice, the arguments that are given today are largely the arguments for partition rather than the arguments for development. Some of these are given at times, but the other is what is more stressed. Perhaps the other is easier to make plain to the average person. That may be one reason why they're stressed more than these. Another reason, of course, is the fact that there is much more diversity regarding some of these now. As ideas of the development of religion have changed and many different viewpoints have been taken. And on that trial in Seattle, the professor from Harvard said that he did not know of any scholar in any university in Europe or America who held the Wellhausen's view any longer. So he made that statement categorically. And when I quoted his predecessor at Harvard, who said we owe it all to Wellhausen, he said, well, he's dead now. And when I quoted a book that had just come out by a retired professor from Union Seminary saying substantially the same thing. Oh, he says he's an old man, no longer teaching. But actually, in the evidence, it became quite clear that what he meant by saying that the Wellhausen theory was no longer held was that the idea, as they say, of unilinear evolution is not advanced. In other words, there are many details of the development of Israelite religion that the Wellhausens presented, which they are other theories, other details presented. But the whole general basis that it is an evolution, that it is a natural development, that it's purely the matter of what people think rather than anything that God has revealed, which was the basic thing in the Wellhausen approach, is now held just as strongly as ever. Now, it is then not so important for our general dealing with people on the matter to be aware of the details of this second type of argument as the first, but one never knows when they will come back into sharp relief again, and it is vital that we have a good understanding of the main feature. And so under that, we will look as number 11 at the first of these arguments, the argument from alleged discrepancy. Now, this is an argument which, in a way, enters both areas, because we, as we noticed in the argument from parallel accounts, that much stress was laid on alleged discrepancies there. We noticed alleged discrepancies in the story of creation, alleged discrepancies in the story of the flood, in the story of the spies, and these various accounts. There are also in the laws, there are many cases where discrepancies are alleged. I have here a big book published many years ago by Esplin Carpenter on the composition of the Hexateuch. And this large volume, in the course of it, lists dozens, perhaps in the hundreds, of alleged discrepancies. Many of these we've already mentioned. Yes? The title is The Composition of the Hexateuch. The Composition of the Hexateuch. It has a mass of material in it. Just an interesting illustration of his general type of approach I think I will read you a small section from it where he is discussing something related to the Hexateuch. English Bible at 1 Samuel 6. You find in 1 Samuel 6 the account of the how the Philistines, who had taken the ark after the death of Eli, finding that they had constant troubles as long as they kept it, decided to send it back to Israel, and how they took two milch cows and tied them at the front of the ark and shut up their calves at home. And we read in verse 11, and they laid the ark of the Lord upon the cart, and the coffer with the mice of gold, and the images of their emerods. And the kine took the straight way to the way of Beth-Shemesh, and went along the highway, lowing as they went, and turned not aside to the right hand or to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them unto the border of Beth-Shemesh. And they of Beth-Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, and rejoiced to see it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua, Beth-Shemite, and stood there, where there was a great stone, and they clave the wood of the cart, and offered the kine a burnt offering unto the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord, and the coffer that was with it, wherein the jewels of gold were, and put them on the great stone. And the men of Beth-Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrificed the same day unto the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron the same day. Now, how many of you noticed a sharp contradiction in what I just read? I think we're so accustomed to reading the style of our English Bible in which there is often a matter stated in general terms and then repeated with the specific detail that you don't notice. But now keep this in front of you. And let me read you what Carpenter says about it. Carpenter says, when the ark was sent back by a Philistine captor, 1 Samuel 6:12, the kine bring the cart in which it has been placed into the fields of Beth-Shemesh, where the villages are gathering the wheat harvest. The cart stops beside a great stone. The grateful reapers immediately extemporize a sacrifice. The cart is chopped up to kindle the altar fire, and the kine are burned as an offering to Yahweh. When the sacrifice is over, the Levites appear and take down the ark from the cart already burned, and the men of Beth Shemesh repeat the rite. It certainly sounds incongruous the way he describes it, doesn't it? That is, he takes it that we have two successive sentences here that give us two different versions of the same thing. That in verse 14 you read, the cart went into the field of Joshua, Beth Shemite, and stood there where there was a great stone, and they clave the wood of the cart and offered the kine a burnt offering unto the Lord. And then in 15 you have the same thing repeated with more detail. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the coffer that was with it, wherein the jewels of gold were, and put them on the great stone, and the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices the same day unto the Lord. So he takes these two verses as two successive different versions of it. The first of them giving the view characteristic of Jay, according to his view that anybody could offer a sacrifice. The second giving the view of P, that only the Levite could offer sacrifice. And thus gives you the two statements, one right after the other. Well, now, this is an example of, not from the text from the Pentateuch, but related to it, of the sort of arguments that they bring. And of course, we've noticed many of these discrepancies before. I don't think I need to read you two or three pages here in which he lists various alleged discrepancies, but we will notice certain considerations regarding these alleged discrepancies. I want to mention four considerations. Number one, many of the alleged discrepancies are invalid arguments from silence. Many of them are invalid arguments from silence. In connection with the ark, or with the flood, Carpenter says that according to one story, they are to bring one pair in the ark, one pair of every kind of animal. According to the other story, there is a distinction between clean and unclean animals, and they have one pair of the unclean animals and seven pair of the clean animals. Well, now, as we've already noticed, noticing the parallel passages, this is not a contradiction. If you have seven, you certainly have one. And if he were ordered a year or so ahead of time to gather every type of animal, the order to gather one at that time does not in any way contradict a later order that of the type of animals which were called clean animals, the type which were best known to them, and of which they had great numbers close at hand, they could easily add six others of them. It is an argument from silence. There's no contradiction between the two. The same is true as to the difference in the length of time at different stages in connection with the flood. Many of these alleged discrepancies are invalid arguments from silence. We've touched on that to some extent on this other connection. So I'll go on to number two. Number two, many of them are readily explained if natural assumptions are made and the author given credit for ordinary common sense. Many of them are readily explained if natural assumptions are made and the author given credit for ordinary common sense. We notice how, in connection with Jacob's departure, it is alleged that there are two contradictory stories. According to one of these stories, Jacob went up to Haran because his mother was afraid that he would marry one of the Canaanite women. According to the other story, he went up to Haran because she was afraid that Esau would kill him. It is a reasonable assumption that both elements entered into her mind. There's no necessary contradiction. In this case, I just read from 1 Samuel. If the two statements contradict each other so flatly as Carpenter thinks, then you have to assume when the second is given that it means that it is contradicting the first, that the first is finished before the second starts, and therefore they lifted down the ark off the cart that had already been burned. If you have to assume that, then the man who combined them into one document was certainly an utter idiot to combine things in a way that would make no more sense than that. But of course that is the assumption that they make in many, many cases. Number three, many of them result from considering two different events to be the same event. Many of them result from considering two different events to be the same event. Like saying that you have the story of Abraham saying that Sarah was his sister. One place says he did it in Egypt, one place says he did it in the land of the Philistines. Well, it's perfectly reasonable that if he would do it in one place, he might do it in the other. They are two distinct events. If you assume they're the same event, you produce a contradiction. In the stories of creation, you have the one case where the it starts with a world that is wet, and the world is covered with water. In the other case, the world is dry, and there's no rain yet. And of course, if you consider they are exact parallels, there's a sharp contradiction. But if you consider that one is looking in detail at a small section of the whole story, starting at a different point, there's no necessary contradiction whatever. Number four, even if occasional discrepancies could be proven, it would not establish the Groth-Wellhausen idea of development. Even if occasional discrepancies could be proved, I'm not saying that they are, of course. I do not believe there are any real discrepancies, but I think it's important in noting the relation of the argument to have in mind this fact, that even if you could prove a few discrepancies, this would not necessarily show the development that they maintain. You have to have a relationship between the discrepancies. And as we noticed, the relationship sometimes is quite reverse of what they would claim. As for instance, where they say that the P document has all this extensive ritual difference between clean and unclean animals, what you can eat and what you can't eat and so on, while the J document is a simple primitive story without any of this involved ritual. And yet when they get into the flood story, they say that the idea of having seven pairs of clean animals and one of unclean is a J idea, while the P document simply has the one pair of each. It completely reverses. So alleged discrepancies alone would not establish the Groth-Wellhausen idea of development. I read a book recently, just written within the last 3 or 4 years, in which there's a very fine summary of most that has been written by various scholars for and against the Groth-Wellhausen theory through the last 100 years. A very fun summary, but ending up with the conclusion that the attacks on the Grothian hypothesis have not been proven. The Grothian hypothesis stands definitely, and he makes a great deal. He says, before you can accept the Pentateuch as it stands, you have to explain all these discrepancies. And that, he says, is impossible. Well, discrepancies, if proved, would not establish the idea of development as the Groth-Wellhausen theory holds. So we go on to Roman numeral 12. And Roman numeral 12 will be the argument for development, the argument for development from alleged development of ideas and religious institutions. The argument for development from alleged developments of ideas and of religious institutions. I haven't expressed that point quite as well as I'd like to have. The vital thing in it, in relation to the following one, which we won't come to for some little time now, is that here we're dealing with what is in the Pentateuch itself. That is, the idea, this, if proven, is much more important than number 11 we just looked at. It is the idea that you take the differences and you can arrange the differences in an evolutionary order. And you can see how it goes from the simple to the complex, how it goes from the primitive to the more advanced. Now this we divide in two parts. First, A, the argument from religious ideas. The argument from development of religious ideas. And here in particular, we are interested in the idea of God. The critical books all say that in relation to the idea of God, there is a very definite development within the different documents. They say that the J document has a very primitive idea of God, and that you find this particularly in Genesis 2, in the story of creation. Yes?
I'm sure maybe I've got the wrong idea, but I thought that the development theory did not deal with very sovereign theories.
No. Thank you. That's a good point to clarify. The partition theory is the idea that you can take the whole book and divide it into different sections. The development idea is that there is a development of ideas and institutions found within the Pentateuch, found there by taking the different documents into which partition divided, and seeing how there is a progress of thought from one to the other. So you see, the two bolster one another. If you don't have partition, then it's pretty hard to prove development, unless you can prove it straight through from the beginning of Genesis on the end. But when you take certain sections out and you say, these are primitive, these are more advanced, these are still more advanced, then if you can prove that, it strengthens your idea that you actually have different sections, which you take out. See, the two fit together. And so according to the development idea, there is a progress, and you will find this in all the books that deal with it, that the J document is very primitive. Driver tells you, that is in this idea of God. Driver tells you how God takes the chariot wheels off the Egyptians' chariots in the Red Sea. He pulls the chariot wheels off them as they go through. How in Genesis 2, God forms man out of the dust of the earth. God breathes into him the breath of life. It is God's right arm that does things. God is spoken of constantly in anthropomorphic terms, as if he was a man doing different things. That is the primitive J idea of God, according to the critics. And you have many statements in Genesis 2 and 3. Driver will give you a list of them. A God walks in the garden in the cool of the day. God talks with man in the garden. God, as it got said, God forms man. He breathes into him. All these things. God takes the portion of the island side and he forms it into a woman. All these anthropomorphic terms are typical of the primitive idea of God that Jay had. Now, of course, we interpret those terms, those anthropomorphic terms, as not meaning that God runs along beside the chariots in the Red Sea pulling the wheels off them, but that God, by his divine power, causes that to happen. We interpret all these as somewhat figurative, but we consider it and not at all out of keeping with the spiritual nature of God to use anthropomorphic terms in relation to him. However, if you find a document which is filled with anthropomorphic terms, and you have another document that has no anthropomorphic terms, the critics say, for instance, that the P document has God speaks, God says, let there be light, and there is light. God says, let us create man, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. And he created man in his image after his likeness. God speaks and it is done. The anthropomorphic terms belong in the primitive J concept. So we have the J concept at the one extreme, we have the P concept at the other. Now Driver will tell you that E is in a way between the two, nearer to J than to P, but E is not anthropomorphic, but anthropopathic. That is to say, it expresses not divine actions in human terms, but divine feelings in human terms. It has God feeling sorrowful, God grieving, God rejoicing, terms of feeling such as you use for men's emotions applied to God. Thus they say, in J, God speaks directly to man. In E, God appears to man in the form of a dream or a vision. And in P, they will not be the direct theophanies, according to them, like as in J or in E. So that thus there was widely held 100 years ago an idea that monotheism had developed by a gradual process. Different scholars and anthropologists then used to show the series of steps through which men went from animism and the belief in many spirits and so on, gradually up to the idea of one God. That idea of a definite unilinear evolution whereby the idea of monotheism came into existence has been pretty well exploded today. And today there are many theories as to how men came to believe in one God, but there is no agreement upon any simple system of development by which the idea is said to have come into existence. Now, I want to note then about this alleged development or progress of ideas of God, certain considerations. And so, under A, the argument from the development of religious ideas, I want to express four important considerations. Number one, the seeming difference as to ideas of God between J, E, and P is normal in view of the difference in the type of material. The seeming difference as to ideas of God between J and E and P is normal in view of the difference in the type of material. J and E, as you remember, include most of the narrative material that is attributed by the critics to either J and E or often simply to J-E, as they call it. And the material they give to P, as your papers I suppose will mostly clearly bring out, is mostly tabular, statistical, genealogical dates and very brief statements of places and very little of narrative nature, except perhaps if there's a legal contract like purchasing the cave of Machpelah or something like that of a legal nature. And the same is true in the case of the laws, of course, that it is the formal, systematized, routine laws of Leviticus and so on, descriptions of how to make the tabernacle and all that, that they give to P. Well, now, it is quite natural in tabulations like this, there would not be the same occasion for anthropomorphic terms that there would be in narrative accounts. Where you have Genesis 1, one day, certain great events took place, the second day, certain great events, third day, certain great events, sort of a tabular presentation. There's not much place for describing God as doing something, forming something, as a use of anthropomorphic terms. But in the case where God is dealing with humanity in a narrative style, as in chapter 2, there is much more natural to use anthropomorphic terms. That's point one. Point two, the seeming difference between J and E. The seeming difference between J and E is quite natural, since E has no account of great cosmic events. comma, such as creation and the flood. The seeming difference between J and E is quite natural, since E has no account of great cosmic events, such as creation and the flood. Yes? No, E has no. J has the account of creation. J has the account of flood. Since E has no account of these. You see, first we looked at the big difference between P on the one hand, which is tables, lists, genealogy, and J and E, which are narrative, and anthropomorphisms would naturally come in narrative, and it would be quite unnatural to put them in lists and tabulations and genealogies and statistics. But now we mentioned that they claim there's a difference between J and E, that J has all these expressions, God formed, God spoke, God breathed, all these expressions, while that E, they say, is anthropopathic, but not anthropomorphic. Now, this difference is much harder to demonstrate than the difference between J, E, and P. But actually, it's not so strange there should be such something of a difference of that type, because they give all the material up to Genesis, most scholars say up to Genesis 20, that all the material is either J or P. Some would have some of E as early as 15. But certainly no scholar I've ever heard of put any of E earlier than Genesis 13. Well, then your great cosmic events like the creation and the flood are contained in the earlier portion, none of which is given to E. And when they give you the list of the anthropomorphic expressions used of God, they have more of them in Genesis 2 than almost any other five chapters put together. It's the original relation of God with man in connection with the creation. And this is all given to J. So it's quite natural that your anthropomorphic expressions would go with J rather than with E, which they don't start until later on. Now, a third point, properly interpreted, the view of God in J is really very lofty and not primitive as claimed by the critics. Properly interpreted, the view of God in J is really very lofty and not primitive as maintained by the critics. Some of the older books try to make Genesis 2 sound almost like a child's fairy story. But most of the later writers realized that if there was such a development from very, very primitive ideas on through, that J would come a long way from the beginning of the development. Actually, in Genesis 2, though, there are many anthropomorphic terms. The view of God is as a very lofty being, a being in quite a different category from man, even though these anthropomorphic expressions are used. And I think that is important. You take a phrase out and make it sound primitive, but you interpret it in context, and it is usually not, doesn't have to be interpreted that way at all. Now, in Exodus 4, I believe it is, there is a case which one of the writers, I believe it was Addison, said was a very precious bit of very early writing which has been preserved for us in the J document. This is a very precious bit of early writing showing the primitive ideas preceding the time when J was written, which has been preserved in J, which shows how Yahweh was originally a volcanic God who simply would go on a tear at times and destroy anyone who got in his way. And you listen to it from that viewpoint and see how it fits. Genesis 4:19 following. See the picture of Yahweh as the primitive God that goes on a tear and destroys anyone that gets in his way. I will read then from that viewpoint, instead of saying Lord, which is written in caps here, represents the tetragrammaton, I will read it as the critics give it, read it as Yahweh. And Yahweh said to Moses in Midian, go return unto Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought thy life. And Moses took his wife and his sons and set them upon an ass, and he returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And Yahweh said unto Moses, and then it tells what he said to him and so on, but we go on to verse 24. And it came to pass by the way in the inn that Yahweh met him and sought to kill him. See, here's your wild volcanic god that goes on a tear, and poor Moses happened to get in his way. So Yahweh met him in the inn and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin and cast it at his feet and said, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. So he let him go. Then she said, a bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision. Now you can take this, as the critics do, as a very primitive bit of incident that has been preserved in the J document, showing this wild volcanic god that went on a tear. Moses got in the way. He tried to kill him and could only be appeased with blood. And so Zipporah performed the circumcision, thus causing blood to flow, which appeased the thunder god, and so he let him go. A picture of a very primitive idea of God, more primitive than most of the J document, but preserved for us in the J document. Now that, of course, is the way that the critics would interpret the passage. But it is not necessary to interpret it that way. In line with the rest of the Pentateuch and in line with the J document as a whole, it is possible. It does not. The Bible doesn't have to everywhere spell everything out. There are cases where particular things are described in full detail, and perhaps important principles are mentioned three or four times over to be absolutely sure we understand. There are other places where we have to take what we gather from the Scripture as a whole and apply it in order to understand something. And in this case, if you use this method of applying, of understanding it in relation to Scripture as a whole, it is certainly reasonable to interpret it in such a way as to have an entirely different idea of God. God had commanded that the true believers should give a sign to their children that they were the children of godly parents. And this sign had been commanded to be given, but a person might truly believe in God, but might for some reason or other neglect the sign. That did not mean that the person was lost. The person could be a true believer, but could be mistaken on this point. Or, as in this case, Moses could have felt that he should circumcise his child, but Zipporah said, wait till the child grows up and he can make up his own mind. He can decide then whether he wants to be circumcised or not. Don't do this at this age. And Moses was still saved. He was a true believer. But if Moses was to be the leader of God's people, if he was to be the one whom God would use to carry out his great purposes, then it was vital that Moses should carry through the commandments of God as fully as he could understand. And so here, God has made Moses against his will agree to go back. Moses was impetuous as a young man. He was going to free the Israelites, and he started in his own strength to do it, and he failed. And so he fled into Midian, and he settled down there and lived for 40 years there and had his wife and his child, and he was getting along. And then God came to him and called him back to the task. And how often I've seen that with young fellows. I've seen young fellows who are going to start right out and turn the world upside down. Immediately they're going to make everything right. And the result is they step out with confidence and land on their face. And they fail. And then they settle back and find an easy way to get along and go through their life and no longer try to count for much in God's plan. And God wants us to train and prepare so that when we're ready to do a great work for Him, we have the ability and the training to go ahead and accomplish it. He wants us to do something all the time, but not to think like Moses, we can start right out and turn the world upside down immediately. And then, like Moses, when we fail then, as I've known many a young fellow do, then settle back and never take any real stand for something vital in further years. Well, Moses settled down these 40 years. Now God says to Moses, I want you to go and be the leader. You've got the qualities I want you to have, and you're the one I want to go to to Egypt and deliver my people. And Moses very reluctantly agrees to go, and he starts back to Egypt. But Zipporah has dissuaded him these years from carrying out the commands of God in full, and he starts for Egypt. He says to Zipporah, perhaps we should circumcise the child. We should fulfill the commands of God. And Zipporah says, oh, he's just such a little thing. It's a bloody thing to do, and he's such a little thing. Wait till he grows up and let him make up his own mind. And so they start for Egypt, and then the Lord, we read, met him and sought to kill him. Well, if Yahweh here is just the thunder God of Sinai going on a tear and killing anyone in his way, you can interpret those words in that way. But it is more reasonable, if you accept the Bible as God's word, to accept them in line with the rest of the scripture and think that something happened to Moses there in the inn. He was taken suddenly ill. He was put in a situation where he seemed in danger of his life. And Zipporah immediately realized what was happening. Zipporah realized that Moses, attempting to do God's work, but not doing it in God's way, that Moses was in danger. And Zipporah was willing to give up her ideas on this point rather than to lose Moses. And so Zipporah immediately knew what was involved. And Zipporah immediately grabbed a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son. But she didn't do it very happily. She cast it at the feet of her husband. She says, surely a bloody husband art thou to me. She gave in to keep Moses, yes. But she didn't do it happily. She says, all right, if this is what we got to do, I'd rather do this than lose Moses. But I don't like it. And so the Lord let him go. Moses recovered. And Moses recovered, she still felt bad. She said, a bloody husband thou art because of the circumcision. And then we don't read what happens to Zipporah. But in succeeding chapters, we have no mention of her until after Moses is like out from the land of Egypt. And there his father-in-law Jethro comes to meet him and brings his wife and son with him. And so it would seem that before he got to Egypt, he sent Zipporah back after this event. But there is a way of interpreting it which does not stand obvious and clear right on the surface. The idea of the thunder god of Sinai perhaps is more obvious right on the surface if you're going to take the two verses by themselves and ignore all the rest of the Bible. But if you're going to do as you must with any book that ever was written, interpret individual sentences in the light of the book as a whole. And interpret the character of God here in the light of what we find out about God's character, not necessarily from the whole of the rest of the Pentateuch, just from the J document by itself. Why, the interpretation that we have just mentioned is surely a much more logical and natural interpretation. And so the properly interpreted, the view of God in J is really very lofty. This much will be admitted by most of us. But it is really not as primitive at all as some of their writings on isolated passages like this one would try to make you think that it is. Well, number four. Even though it is claimed that anthropomorphisms are rare in P, some are found there. Anthropomorphisms, they say, you'll find in J. Anthropopathisms in E. P has a lofty idea of God who simply speaks and it is done, is not represented in human terms this way. But look at Genesis 1:26, which all the critics will say is a part of the P document, as the whole of chapter 1 is. And you read, God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. What can be much anthropomorphic than that? In our image after our likeness. Those are surely physical anthropomorphic terms, which even in P here we find used. Another interesting instance of the few that can be found in the enumerative statistical type of material that they give to P is in Numbers 6:22. Follow. In Numbers 6:22, we have a passage which must be given to P, because it tells about Aaron and his son. And the P document, the P document is the one that stresses Aaron, that stresses the priesthood. That's the P document. The D document has simply the Levites, and in the J document, anybody can offer sacrifice. But this is the P document. It's Aaron and his sons. And here, and all the material just before it is very clearly the P type, the laws of the Nazarites and so on. So we read here, and the Lord said to Moses, spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, on this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee. Make his face shine on you. What can be more anthropomorphic than that? To make the face shine on somebody. If there's a primitive expression anywhere, surely that's one. Make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his face upon thee. The word face in this case is translated countenance in our English Bible. The Lord lift up his face upon thee and give thee peace. Here are certainly as anthropomorphic expressions as anything you'll find anywhere in the J doctrine. This is P. Yes?
Perhaps
the focus
of the J doctrine.
Oh, no, the P doctrine.
Is this the P doctrine?
Yes. I say this is as anthropomorphic as anything you'll find in the J doctrine anywhere. Yes, after Exodus 6:3, they all use God. After Exodus 6:3, there are very, very few places where the name Elohim is used. They all use Yahweh after that. Yes? Of the stock, on the basis of the stock. This is the law of the such and such sacrifice. You shall do this to this part, you shall do this to this part, do this to this part, do this to this part. That is the law of this sacrifice. Here's the law of this sacrifice. You do this to this, this to this, this to this. Here's the way you build the tabernacle. You make boards of a certain type. You stand them in a certain way. It's all this enumerative, genealogical, statistical type of material. The names of God are of no use in separating the documents after the early chapters of Exodus. Yes. So you see that even though in dividing into types of writing as they do, it is natural that the anthropomorphism would not be in the P doctrine. Yet we have these two places in the P doctrine which are as anthropomorphic as anything you'll find anywhere in the J doctrine. Now, the great source of argument and discussion for the critical view is found in the matter of development as regards religious institutions. The argument as regards ideas of God, while it will often be referred to in general discussion, it only enters comparatively little into their main argument. But religious institutions is the big point, the big center of their argument of development. And we'll start that tomorrow morning.